You all seen the movie Contact? Great movie. It's a great flick. A lot of people think it's about traveling to the center of the universe with some weird machine done by some vegan aliens. That's not the point of the movie. The point of the movie is this basic question: is there a God? And in this movie, there are two characters that represent two very prominent philosophical standpoints. You got one who is portrayed as a scientist who needs empirical data, who needs to have things proven to her, and she follows that code to the nth degree. And that character is played by Jodie Foster. And then on the other hand, you've got this Matthew McConaughey kind of, I don't know how to describe him. He's, I guess you'd say, spiritual and religious in most ways. He was a Catholic priest who just couldn't handle the whole celibacy thing, and so he gave it all up, but yet he still has that religious belief system. He characterizes himself as a man of the cloth, just without the cloth. And I do have to say his morals may not be the most upright, especially in the opening scenes when he and her kind of hook up, and I'm like, man, this is a first date. You guys aren't married. And so, but I just tell you that because he has a different code that he lives by, and that is a code that integrates God and faith into his belief system. Now, this was based on a novel written by Carl Sagan, and I'm actually very surprised at how this movie actually ended up. It actually ended with the Jodie Foster character coming more aligned with the character of Matthew McConaughey, which is pretty big to move from there over to here. And that's exactly what we're going to be discussing. In this clip that I want to show you, there were three clips. I was agonizing. You can ask my wife. Last night I was agonizing over which of the three clips. And I tell you this right now. Go out this week and rent it or rewatch it if you have it, or go out and buy it or something. The Blockbuster on Tustin, they only have one copy, and I've rented it, so you can't have that one. But I guess there's other. I was just talking with Bob, and he says there's others that have even more copies. So that is the basic question that is being asked: is there a God? Now, what you're going to see here is they've discovered they've had this communication from some advanced life form in the Vega system, and they've got this machine that they've developed by these Vegan blueprints, and they're going to try and use it to travel. They don't know exactly how it's going to work, but they're just following the blueprints, and they need someone to enter into this machine in order to figure out how it works out. And so they're doing this interview system, and of course, the Jodie Foster character who discovered it all, she is one of the 10 finalists. And so she has to come before the panel and be asked a series of questions. Now, the panel is made up of a bunch of engineers, mathematicians, and religious leaders, strangely enough. And guess who ended up on the panel? Well, Matthew McConaughey. So if you see a little tension there between the Matthew McConaughey character and the Jodie Foster character, that's the reason why. But again, it gets down to the very basic core belief, core question: is there a God? Let's watch it now, The Contact.
And your stamina. I believe we are ready to move on to your final statement.
Madam Chairman, I have one more question.
Yes, Mr. Jones.
Dr. Arroway, would you consider yourself a spiritual person?
I don't really understand the point of the question. I consider myself a moral person.
I'm sure we all agree that is the case, but I think what Mr. Joss is in fact asking...
Do you believe in God, Dr. Arroway?
As a scientist, I rely on empirical evidence, and in this matter, I don't believe that there is data either way.
So your answer would in fact be that you don't believe in God?
I don't understand the relevance of the question.
Dr. Arroway, 95% of the world's population believes in a supreme being in one form or another. I believe that makes the question more than relevant.
Dr. Arroway? I believe, I've already answered that question.
There it is, the basic question. is there a God? And where does the Jodie Foster character, Dr. Arroway, land on that spectrum? I really enjoyed that clip because it points out a few things. It starts us off with some definitions. So, write these definitions down right there. Atheist, agnostic, theist. This kind of gives us a basic building block of where to work at. What is the definition of an atheist? Well, A is usually a negating term. So if you put A in front of a word, you're negating it. So an atheist would be someone who believes that there is no God. So an atheist believes there's no God. Now, an agnostic. A, negation. Gnostic means knowledge. So an agnostic would be someone that says they just don't know if there is a God or not. And then you have theists, those that believe that there is a God. Now, it is true, the quote that they said in there is actually true. 95% of the world's population believes in some divine being in some form or another. I don't care if you call him God, a human energy, a flowing river of power, whatever you want to call it, 95% of the world's population believes that there is a God. So there's not that many atheists and agnostics out there. And I'll say this, I don't think there's many atheists out there. I truly believe that. Now, in the character here of Jodie Foster, it appears that she is an atheist. And I disagree with that. I don't think she landed on that because what did she say? I just don't think that there's stuff on either side. So what she's saying, I just don't know. And that's where most people, if they don't believe in a God, that's where they land. They just have not investigated the claims. They just haven't looked at the data to find out one way or another. And why don't they do that? Same reason the Jodie Foster character. Who cares? What is the relevance of there being a God? Who really cares if there is such a supreme divine being? It just doesn't have any bearing on our life. So it's interesting, if you ever meet up with someone who claims to be an atheist or agnostic, you can find out really quickly because all you have to do is ask them if they've ever investigated the claims. If you've investigated the claims and still say there is no God, then I would call you a true atheist. And you land in a very, very small minority of the world's population. If you were an agnostic, you say there's no God, and I say, have you investigated the claims, and you say no, then I would probably characterize you as an agnostic, and you landed in a little bit larger category than the atheist, and that is because that's where I think most people are at. Now, you probably have friends or family, or maybe you yourself land in that category, and that's the reason why we need to talk about this today, because there is supreme relevance to all of this discussion. In another one of the clips, Jodie Foster is telling the Matthew McConaughey character, she says, you know what, I just can't believe that there is some mysterious God out there that has not given us any proof, any artifact, anything that proves his existence. And that to me immediately says that she's an agnostic, because there are major proofs that are out there, proofs that even scientists have been wrestling with for thousands and thousands of years, and that's the reason why we're going to take a look at some of those proofs today, so that at the end of this day, if you say, you know what, I still think all of these arguments are wrong, then you can be well-informed atheist, and you won't be on the agnostic category. And I'm hoping that after the arguments, you will at least come to the conclusion of the 95% of the world's population that there is a God of some sort or another, and then we'll address the question, what kind of God is he? Who is he? All right, so here are the arguments. There's three major ones out there. The first two are really the biggest one, creation, morality, and freedom. We're going to hit these one by one. We're going to talk about them again. Stop me at any time. Raise your hand. Say, I think you're full of baloney. Let's talk about this. If you have more to say on it, you can do that as well. But we definitely need to discuss this. So we're going to talk about creation. Under creation, there's two major things, and that is cause and effect and intelligent design. Let's talk about cause and effect. You talk to any scientists, and you will say that they believe in this idea of cause and effect. And the idea is that if I take a piece of paper and I drop it, I caused that piece of paper to drop. Everything is made up of cause and effect. You take a look at yourself, and I can say you came from parents. That the cause had you as the effect, and then your parents were also caused. And you see how there's this cycle. Well, who caused those parents? Well, parents beyond that, and parents beyond that, and parents beyond that. So you got this kind of real big, long string of cause and effect. Now, there's only two options. Either A, the universe is eternal and has never had a beginning, or B, it had a beginning. Now, I can tell you this. If you think that the universe has had no beginning, you are in a very, 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 very small category of people. Even scientists, even atheist agnostic scientists, usually say that the world, the universe, had a beginning. What do they usually call that? The Big Bang, right? Most people nowadays don't even mention the idea that there was no beginning, that it was eternal. So if we say that there was a beginning, then that gets us on some good level playing ground. Now, again, if you're a scientist, you would say that the beginning was this whole idea of the Big Bang. You talk about how galaxies are moving away, and you can track them through Doppler and heat waves, and you can see that everything's moving away. So somehow, in the beginning, there was this huge, monstrous explosion that kind of set everything into orbit. That was the beginning, and that's where they stand. And we come along, we say, well, how did that happen? What caused the Big Bang to happen? Where did the matter come from in the first place? And we would say, hold on a second, I'll get to you, Kim, that we would say that God caused all that to happen. They would say, we just don't know. We would come along and say God. Yes, Kim, what's your question?
That was pretty much it, how we can incorporate the idea of science behind it with God.
Yes, yeah, we believe that there was a beginning. I don't know if it was the Big Bang or not, but we believe that there was a beginning. Something set the whole thing in motion, and that was God. Now, of course, you have been plagued with these questions from your children. Incessantly, they ask you, who caused God? Right? Haven't you all heard that? Or at least questioned that yourself. You say, well, wait a second. If there was this beginning, and God caused the beginning, who caused God? Well, at that point, you just landed into the eternal category, right? Because if something caused God, then that being itself must have been caused, which is, again, now we're back into that conundrum, that quandary of everything's eternal. God, by his very definition, is uncaused and eternal. God, by his very definition, is uncaused and eternal. So, which is when people say, who caused God? We say, no one, because God has always existed. That's by the very definition. If something created God, then that wouldn't really be God, would it? Right? So, I just lost my whole train of thought because I'm trying to remember where that stinking joke comes in. Now I'm dying. Yeah, I'll get to that joke in a moment. So there you go. The answer to the question of who caused God, no one. He's eternal. Oh, that's where I was going. Okay. We have a real difficult, hard time struggling with this. Why? Because we are finite beings. You have a beginning. You have a birthday, the day that you were born. And I can guarantee you this, you have a death day. Someday, you're going to die. You have a beginning. You have an end. How can something that has a beginning and an end understand something that's eternal? It's impossible, isn't it? Our human minds cannot comprehend that because we are finite beings. But if you start playing with this thing logically, you will see that either the universe was eternal or that it had a beginning. If you say that it had a beginning, something caused it. Well, who caused it? There had to be something which in and of itself was uncaused, which set the whole thing into motion, and there thus proves the existence that there is something. Again, I don't care what you call it, a power, a force, a mind, an energy field, but something outside of space and time caused the first thing. That's the cause and effect. It's hard to get around that one. That's where most scientists, again, usually what they'll do is they'll say, we have a beginning, and we say, who caused it? And they go, I don't know. If they say, I don't know, what does that mean? They are an agnostic. Again, they're not an atheist at that point. They just don't know. They haven't investigated the claims. Intelligent design. When you take a look at the world around you, you might come to the very quick conclusion that something had to make it all. Right? If you were walking down the street, maybe you've heard this analogy, if you're walking down the street and you saw this watch sitting on the ground, you would probably not say, oh my goodness, look at how the wind blew and the earth shook and all these pieces just kind of, and there out came this watch. No, you wouldn't say that. Why? Because you look at it and you say, wow, that's intricate. That's complex. It's got a Batman logo on it. My goodness, it's got working parts. That's incredible. There must have been someone, we would call that person a watchmaker, who created this thing. There is an intelligent designer. And when you start taking a look at the human body, or you start taking a look at creation around you, you have to come to a conclusion that things are so intricate and so detailed that there had to be an intelligent designer behind that. And one thing that we usually look at is the eye. How in the world does the eyeball work? We still haven't figured it out. Somehow with lights and cones and rods and retinas and images that get zapped into our optical thing, which gets into our brain, and then we can actually have vision, is such an intricate piece that a lot of people have a struggle with it. Guess who had struggles with the eye? Charles Darwin. Take a look at this quote. Whammo. To suppose that the eye could have been formed by natural selection seems, I freely confess, absurd in the highest degree. Darwin himself. That's pretty big, if you ask me. The man who came up with this idea, I found out some more information. He was a Christian, and yet, and he's trying to develop this thing, and natural selection to try and explain it all. My goodness. Even he says, there's got to be a problem with it. Again, there's only two ways. There's only two categories you can land in. Either A, we were created beings, or B, we came about by accident. And this is where that eyeball thing has a major problem. Because how could this thing be created by accident? That is just amazingly impossible. Take a look at this next thing. A human cell. Every cell in the body is made up of approximately 200,000 amino acids, proteins that are formed in just the right combination in a huge long string to actually be created. Now, and that's, I don't know which cell that is. It could be your skin cell, could be your hair cell, could be your jail cell. Every cell comes with 200,000 amino acids strung together. Now, you take one of those things and put it out of place, and your whole thing melts down. It just doesn't work. To have 200,000 amino acids come together by accident, by chance, takes 1,350 billion years. That's 43.5 times the estimated age of the Earth. Whoop! And that's one cell. We're not talking about how all the cells even work together, how all of these pieces come together in such an amazing puzzle that they can actually work. How can we look at each other and say, you're an accident? I look at you and I think, my goodness, you are so intricately designed. There must have been a designer, a watchmaker behind you that created you and made you who you are. And that's why Psalms 19 says this. The heavens declare... Sorry, I better read it because I don't have... The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hand. That's why I have that written on there. When you take a look at creation and all the stuff that's there, again, you got one of two options. Either we are created by evolution, by accident, you get the right primordial soup together and you zap it enough times with some electrical charges and something's going to come out. Or did we come about through a created being? Now, I do admit that there is a little middle ground in there, something. Some people say that God kind of gave all the stuff and then it just kind of happened. That one's pretty hard. That's like saying, you know, let's just take a bunch of bricks and blow them up a bunch of times and hope that it forms the Taj Mahal. I mean, it's just not going to happen. Or have enough tornadoes rip through some junkyards and actually have a working car be assembled after that. That's exactly what we're saying when we come across this idea of creation through evolutionary processes. Not only are the chances so infinitesimally small, but how can we have such an intricate, amazing piece of machinery be created unless there was an intelligent designer behind it? Next slide should be a black slide. Good. I pause for station identification. Questions or comments or insults? Yes, Megan. Oh, wait, I didn't even tell my joke yet. Okay, I'll tell my joke.
Well, I think it was John who said it last time, that the eye is one of the few body parts that's irreducible.
Yeah, yeah. In the last service, we had, and there you go. He's illustrating my next point, too. Well, the freedom one. A gentleman said that the eye was, what did he say, irreducibly complex, that even Darwin himself, that's why he came up with that quote, was if you can't reduce a thing to something very simple and basic, then chances are it didn't come about by accident. And that's the reason why he said about the human eye, it was irreducibly complex. Again, I invite you to start investigating this. I'm only giving you, you want to talk about scratching the surface. I mean, I am just barely hitting this stuff. But there is so much body of literature out there that I could point you to, and that as you start researching the complexity of the world and how it works, and the amazing things about, I mean, just even how Earth is set up. I mean, any larger or any smaller or any further away from the sun or closer to the sun, and nothing could ever exist here. Just water coursing through your veins causes your body to move toxins and to actually function. If water was just a little bit different, your blood would be like sludge and you couldn't exist. I mean, the amazing complexities of it all. And that's the reason why even Darwin himself, if you take a look at Darwin's material at the latter end of his life, that's when he started coming to more of these conclusions about, man, I think my stuff really stinks. But so many people have taken his earlier material and have developed a whole religion out of it. Yes, Carol?
Where the dinosaurs come in.
Oh, bless you. Bless you. Where's those dinosaurs? Yes, yeah, everyone always, well, we didn't have that at the last one, but the dinosaurs are a very big question.
Kids always ask me that, huh?
Yeah, let me go into that really quickly, and of course this will lengthen our discussion by at least 15 minutes, but that's okay. No, I'll try and cut out some other things. The dinosaurs are an interesting thing because I actually have some theories on this. I've read some major literature on this. I'm not an expert on this, but the creation of the world, if you can imagine the world that was created, where do we find most of the dinosaur stuff, relics and bones and all that stuff. Where do we find those? Yeah, like in which area of the world? Yeah, well, we got a lot of stuff in America, don't we? Right? Have we found any dinosaur relics in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley? No. Why? Why do I ask such a specific question? Because where did the history of mankind begin? Tigris-Euphrates Valley. That's where Adam and Eve started. That's where then everything. Now you could imagine. If God says, hey, we got to start somewhere, here's Adam and Eve, whammo, what is he going to do with the rest of the world? Throw a few big dinosaurs on there, let them, you know, stop running and take care of each other. I have no problem with dinosaurs. I have no problem. Now, what I do have a problem with is somehow the way we carbon date them. Carbon dating is definitely going out the window. It is being proven more and more as an inaccurate way to determine the age of something. And so they come up with these really wacky figures of that. And then, of course, the missing link and cavemen. You know, I don't see anything of that stuff in the stuff. But dinosaurs, sure, they could happen. In fact, I think dinosaurs were mentioned in the Bible. They talk about an animal that was so huge that its tail could knock down huge houses and that its neck was so long. Whew, I don't know, it sounds like a brontosaurus to me. Yeah, I think so. So I think dinosaurs are compatible with the Christian religion just because they roamed all over the place. They made the Brea tar pits. Well, yeah, because Adam and Eve didn't hang out in Brea. I don't know why anyone would want to hang out in Brea. Ooh, did I get... Oh, there's some Brea people here. Bless your heart. So, pardon? Yeah, the giants had to have something to write. So there you go with dinosaurs. There you go with dinosaurs. Any other questions on that? Oh, yeah, let me tell you the joke that Megan was referring to. Again, a lot of people say that we came about by accident. There's this joke about this atheist talking with God, and God said, well, you know what? I created man from the dust of the earth, from dirt. And the atheist said, so what? Who cares? I can do the same thing. And he says, okay, let's see you do it. And so the atheist goes, and he's going to scoop up some dirt and try and create man. And God says, wait, go get your own dirt. Oh, zippity-doo-dah. Poor God. Yeah, you're talking about some major stuff. Where did all the dirt come from for life to happen in the first place? There's that that cause and effect thing. Who started the whole thing? Either matter was eternal and this thing has existed for forever and ever. Most people don't do that. You start somewhere, and that's the beginning, a prime mover, a prime shaker. Yes?
Can you tell me where in the Bible it talks about dinosaurs?
Well, you know, it doesn't actually say, and the dinosaurs did this. But there are, I'd have to find, you know, let me write myself a note. Yeah, Job talks about a huge monstrous sea creature, and then it has another one. The Leviathan was this huge sea creature, and then another thing called the Behemoth, and the Behemoth is, I think, a brontosaurus. And again, you know, could you imagine, wouldn't that be stupid of God? What? Job 40, look at that. See, people know the Bible better than I do. So there's a few references, and again, think about it. If God created Adam and Eve and then stuck a bunch of Tyrannosaurus rexes around them, That'd be a good way to extinct life pretty quickly. How did the dinosaurs die? I think the flood. Yeah, makes sense. Killed everything. Worldwide flood. Destroyed it all. Not some major comet. Oh. All right, so there you go. So when you take a look at creation and cause and effect and intelligent design, you come up with the conclusion that there is a God of some sort. Again, I don't care. Is he an energy force? Is he a field? Is he power? Is he a flowing river? Is he just a mind, a light? I don't care. We'll get to that in a moment, but there is something. We have to at least say that. Now, you cannot tell a whole lot about an architect by the house that he builds. You could probably figure out a few things about him, but you're not going to get a personality. You're not going to get a creativity and understanding of who this person is. You cannot get a relationship with an architect just by hanging out and living in his house. You have to get to know the architect himself, which is why we take a look at creation. We come to the idea that there is some God out there, but then who is he? We need a little bit more. Here's some more argument. The morality argument. And this, if you've ever heard of a guy by the name of C.S. Lewis, he was a guy that was an atheist and then became a Christian after investigating the claims. In fact, that's how most, almost all atheists that investigate the claims actually become Christians. I mean, I've heard that written so many times. And C.S. Lewis did a bunch of radio broadcasts on the BBC, and his big argument for the proof and existence of God is morality. We have instilled in us a sense of right and wrong. Don't we? And this is universal. You can go any tribe into Africa, and you will find out very quickly that killing people is just not acceptable. It's just not something you do. Yet stealing, being a coward, those are things that have somehow been instilled in us to have this sense of right and wrong. Now, some people will say, well, you know, we have different senses of morality, though. I mean, take a look at the 1950s. We used to lynch black people. Well, what happened there? You're saying that they were instilled with that thing, and that's where that whole sin problem comes in. There's varying degrees of this whole killing question. We all admit freely that killing people in cold-blooded murder is not acceptable. And again, you can find this anywhere you go. And where did this morality come from? Where did it get into us? Was it through society? Well, no, I don't think so, because that in and of itself has been evolving, and we continue to come up with better morality. Well, how can we come up with a better morality unless we have a measuring stick to put it up against? How do we know that something is better than the other? How come when someone cuts you off in the parking lot and takes your parking space, you go, that's not fair? Well, who says? Is there some rule book somewhere that's been written that says that's not fair? Why has that been instilled into you? And you can do this with atheists or agnostics. I mean, my goodness, that you go up and you slug them and you say, wow, was that fair? And they're probably going to slug you back. You know, they themselves have been instilled with morality. And why is it when we make mistakes, we scream and yell at our spouse and then we try and blame it on something? I had a bad day. I'm just having struggles at work. Why are we defending it? Who cares if we yell at our spouse? If we came about by accident, who cares? Because anything goes at that point. But we don't say that, do we? Even the non-Christians will say that there's been instilled in us a sense of morality. And this is what the Bible calls it. Romans 2:15, since they show that they refers to Gentiles, i.e. non-Christians. Non-Christians show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts. Their consciences also bearing witness. We have this thing called a conscience that seems to catch us every time we do something wrong. We go, oh. Now, I'm not saying that there's defects. Things that somehow go wrong, we do have blind people and deaf people, and we have people that have removed morality from their whole life. But that's not the norm, is it? The norm is we have all been instilled with a sense of morality. And because of that, there has to be something that put it there. It's something, God, supreme being. Man, I'm slam dunking this thing, aren't I? Any questions? Duke it out. Throw down the gloves. Yes, Kim.
This might be answered later when you deal with sin, but the possibility of people murdering and not feeling remorse for it.
Yeah. Those are the people I think that have that defect. I mean, you talk to most murderers, when they murder, they do feel a sense of remorse, or if nothing else, they try and excuse it. They're trying to hide their remorse under excuses. Why are they trying to excuse it? Well, because they know deep down that there was something that they did wrong. Or they try and justify it in other ways. Well, who cares? Why not just go out and kill someone? It doesn't matter if we're all just a bunch of accidents walking around. You know, stuff like that's going to happen. If we're all just people that have been evolved, well, then it doesn't matter. No, there's something that we still say is right and wrong. And even the funny thing is with killing. What about the cops or the people that are in the wars? Why do we say that killing's okay and other killing's wrong? Do you see? We're starting to say one is right and one is wrong. Oh, who said? Where's the measuring stick? How did we come up with that? Why do we say things in the 1950s were wrong morally? Why can we say that we evolve morally? Well, because we've got to have some sort of measuring stick that's telling us, that's prompting us, saying this is right and this is wrong. God. Yes, Seth.
What about the change in morality that you see in the Bible with the fact that so many of the, a number of the characters in the Old Testament had numerous wives and concubines and stuff like that, and it seems like there wasn't a backlash against that the morality was okay, you know, and now we would say that would be completely different. That seems to be that we're taking a cultural context and placing it on them, and that changes the morality.
Yeah.
Doesn't that change the argument of morality? Saying that we're looking at it through our own culture.
You think so? You think we're just looking at? You think that the morality that we have developed is a cultural morality?
I'm playing the other side.
Oh, I know you are. I don't doubt you, Seth. I'll see you in heaven. I know you're playing with me here.
What I'm saying is it seems like the morality of the Old Testament, and I know that the whole sin thing comes in too. But when you see Solomon with all of his wives and all of his concubines. And yet he was a righteous man of God. I mean, it says that oftentimes in the Bible.
Sure.
That he was wise, wiser than anybody else. And you see that I just see that there's a paradox there.
Yeah, I think in some ways, again, because in some things we would say they're cultural. Taking us to tribes in Africa, yeah, they might have multiple wives or loopholes or stuff like that, but there still seems to be this sense, how come you are instilled with the sense that that's wrong? Why are you questioning Solomon and all his wives?
Well, how come Solomon wasn't doing that same thing?
I don't know. Again, why did Hitler kill a bunch of Jewish people?
So why did we let it all goes back to sin?
I believe so. Yeah, when you talk about Solomon being a righteous person, it definitely does not say Solomon was a perfect person.
Oh, no, not
yeah.
at all.
And again, something that was culturally very acceptable in his day, we would say, has evolved. The same thing with the 1950s. Back in those days, it was culturally acceptable to treat people of other color in a bad way. We would say, no, we have evolved morality-wise, and we've come to better conclusions. So,
does that mean the standard changed. It just means how we're applying it.
Yeah, maybe that would be a better way to say it. Again, the application of it, and we also have to understand wives and concubines and what that meant back then. If I was married and cheating on my wife, that really wasn't how that was more of a cultural slash treaty creation, stuff like that. But the application is definitely different than the way they did it back then, the way we do it now. But there still seems to be the sense that you're saying that was wrong. Well, why are you saying it's wrong? Because somewhere deep down you still have that sense of morality of something about that was not quite right. And that's, that measuring stick that says that something has been instilled in us. And it's been applied in different ways. Maybe we'll have to talk more about that. Okay, good. Yes?
There's quite a few things in the Old Testament that... The New Testament kind of augments or it says it's no longer valid. But such as the right to kill your child for being disobedient to you, sell people into slavery, when Lot offers up his daughters to the town, which always bugged me.
Oh, I know, that one bugged me too.
And then there's another situation where somebody gives his wife and gets her back, like cut up into pieces.
Oh, yeah.
And it's disturbing. And but I know that the New Testament deals with some of that, but some of it's never, it's still there and it's not offset by the New Testament, but we still don't recognize it. Because Jesus never said there shall not be no slavery.
We
still look at, even though it says that that's okay in the Old Testament, it's not offset by the New Testament, but we still see it as being not correct.
Then again, why do we see that as not correct? why not let it be right, unless we have a sense of morality that is evolving.
Yeah, but that doesn't match up with Scripture.
Yeah, I'm actually taking it just one step further then. Why do we look back on that and say, that was wrong?
Was that the influence of God?
Well, we might talk about sin, or we might talk about cultural context, but at the same time, again, that cultural context is shifting and changing, and the whole premises are still the same, the whole idea about God and respect and stuff like that, but it's being applied in different ways.
I mean, the same thing, I was just going to make a comment on what she was saying and the way I've always said it, is that God is in sort of a process of revealing himself in human history,
uh-huh.
And that hasn't stopped.
No, it hasn't.
It hasn't even now, and I think that's part of what we're seeing here in these tensions that we're feeling with these old practices that we now kind of find revolting. And I think that, like, it's the same thing, like, the Jews didn't know that God was triune. He hadn't revealed that to them yet. There's tons of things that were unrevealed.
Right. And we continue to keep above, we eventually say we have different, well, that's why we have Supreme Courts, right? Supreme Courts are trying to tell us now what is the right or the wrong, but it's going to be funny because 20 years from now, what will be different? You know, what will we be saying that this is right and this is wrong? Again, not the deepest sense. There might be different interpretations and applications, but still that basic sense of morality will still be existing in us. Yes?
Couldn't an argument be made, and I'm kind of playing the other side of the fence here, but morality are those things that we've developed or we pass on to our children or that somehow are ingrained into our species now, those rules that propagate the species best rather than...
we do that in order to have the common good. And you know what? I don't think that ever happens. I don't think that we ever do anything in this world for the common good unless the good is me. We do things out of a very much selfish ambition. Let's take children, for instance. Why do we try and instill in them this concept of sharing or not hitting? Well, that would be the sin factor in there, but why is our sense of morality better than what they're doing? Well, because we've been given that sense of morality, maybe not for the common good, but probably for the common me. Because often things, as you saw, the common good were not Hitler and his promulgation of the species of the Aryan race. That was not for the common good unless you were white with blue eyes and blonde hair. So it was a very focusing. So I think a lot of times people say we have the sense of morality for the betterment of the society, and I don't know if that's really the case. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know that I would focus on that part of it so much, or that that's what I find interesting about the argument. It's that it's not the common good part of it. It's that we're passing on, say, our genetic material. And, for example, it wouldn't necessarily be common good because if I go out, I have children, which is passing on, but then I go out and I kill a bunch of people, I'm not going to be in a position then to take care of my children and make sure that they grow up and are able to then pass it on and propagate that.
Yeah, but why did you kill the people in the first place? Chances are they cut you off on the freeway and so you wanted to shoot them because...
No, but what I'm saying is that we wouldn't do that. That's part of the rules that get laid down because we know if we do go out and hurt other people, that's going to take away our ability.
I think you're right, and a very wise person could say that. But again, often if you talk to most murderers in jail cells, they're going to say, at that time, this or this, and so I was thinking about myself. That's the same thing with marital infidelity. I mean, if guys really stopped to think about it, if guys and girls really stopped to think about it and said, if I go and do this, this is going to ruin my marriage, it's going to ruin my witness to my kids, they're probably going to grow up screwed up for the rest of their lives too, that would probably keep you from unzipping your zipper. But why do we do it? Because we're in the heat of the moment and it felt good and that's what we want to do at that moment to satisfy us. And so at that time, yeah, if we can always go beyond that, that would be good, but we often don't because of the sin factor.
Well, if God is God,
God is God,
and he's just and good,
okay,
there must be his standard.
Yes, I would say that.
And you talk about morality evolving. You're just looking at cultural change.
But there's still...
the standard is set by God, and we know that. In the Old Testament, just because God allowed it doesn't mean he felt it was right. Malachi itself says that Moses allowed divorce because of the hardness of their heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so evil is sometimes used to bring about good.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way to say it. I think that's right. That we seem to be growing up further and further, just as we would in faith or in years and stuff like that. We do the same thing with morality. Eventually we come to the conclusion, you know what, I don't think this was God honoring. You know what we might have to do? You know what, we're going to...
I'm on a different subject.
Oh, okay.
can we say from a Christian point of view that our morality then doesn't, it, you know, yes, it's written on our hearts by God, but it comes from our parents through the Bible. You know, it's through...
No, because atheists believe that you shouldn't kill someone.
No.
How did they get that?
I'm talking about from a Christian point of view.
Okay.
As a Christian, I know I got my morality from the upbringing that I had. From my parents.
Okay.
Who got it from their parents, you know, growing up in a Christian home.
Okay.
That's where my morality comes from.
Okay.
It originally goes back to you know, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and from Adam and Eve. You know, and... So doesn't that set us apart differently, morals-wise?
No, I think we might have more specific, more applications of how it comes about. But again, we're all still instilled with that one sense of morality. Even atheists, anyone that doesn't believe in God, is still instilled with the idea that some things are right and some things are wrong. Some things are right and some things are wrong. Now, we apply it further and in more various cases as Christians because we believe further in the Bible. But just in general... A general consensus is that there is a morality. And how did we get it? God. I'm going to move on. If you want to talk to me afterwards and set a time in my day planner, we'll talk about it. But we definitely need to move on or else we're going to be here till 3 o'clock. The freedom argument. Go to the next slide. It's black. There you go. Now, this is an interesting argument. I had never heard this one before until I just finally read it. And it's a really interesting argument. What I've got here is baking soda and vinegar. What's going to happen if I pour this vinegar on this baking soda? It's going to smell. What else are you going to do? It's going to foam? Is that what someone said? You think so? Are you sure? Unless it's not vinegar or not baking soda. But if this is true baking soda and this is vinegar, you are 100% confident that that's what it's going to do. Well, zippity-doo-dah. Look at that. It did it. This is the freedom argument. And this says to us that we could not have come about by accident or natural things. So many people say that we are just chemical reactions taking place. If we are just chemical reactions taking place, I mean, can the baking soda choose not to foam? Can it say to itself, you know what, I'm not going to foam today, even though this vinegar is poured on me? No, it cannot. It has to do it because it's governed by laws that says this is how chemicals react with other chemicals. Well, then how in the world do you have choices and have freedom to do things? How come you can make decisions to do this or not do that? Where did your freedom come from? Because if you just came about by accident, by chemical processes that were zapped enough times and then you were a frog landed on land and then became standing and beating dinosaurs over the head, if that's the case, then you are just a bunch of chemical processes. You should react in the same way as everyone else does in the same circumstance. And yet that doesn't happen, does it? You have tremendous freedom to do what you will. We would call that free will. Or just choice. You have choices that you can make because you are not just a bunch of chemical reactions. Granted, chemical reactions take place in your body, but you are not governed by them. They might influence you, but you have the ultimate choice to decide what to do. There's that whole slapping argument again. If I come up and slap you, if the chemical reaction was correct, you should probably slap me back. But Jesus says, turn the other cheek. How can we make that free choice not to do that if we're just not a bunch of chemicals? Something is telling us in the freedom argument that we have a little bit more freedom to do what we want because we are not simply chemical reactions. We are created beings instilled with something else. There's a freedom argument. Okay. Let me move on because this is really important because at this point, yeah, hopefully you've come to the idea. Now, with all this, again, maybe you're thinking that the morality argument is not a very good argument. Well, take that in conjunction with other things, and you're going to find out pretty quickly that there's something going on here, that at least the 95% that says that there is a God is good. Now, the question is, how can we know which God is the right God? How come we as Christians say, this is the right answer? This is the right God. We've got him. Can the real God please stand up? How come we've made that determination? What about the Baha'is or the Hindus or anyone else that says that it's just like a big old flowing river? How do we know that a God actually exist. And that's where I came, I saw this word, I didn't come up with it, self-authentication. It's kind of cool. How does God show himself to us? And I think he shows us to us in a variety of ways. Now, the main way that we would like to be shown is through appearances. We would like God to just kind of show up on the scene, wouldn't we? We are people that love to have our senses, and most importantly, our vision, to be stimulated, to have proof given to us. When she was talking about having proof, she wanted to see something with her own eyes. And that's how we seem to want to function. And that even happened in the New Testament, right? Check this out from the book of John. Jesus appears to 10 of his disciples. One guy's missing. Guy named Thomas. Judas is already dead. Thomas is still around. And he says, well, wait a second. And they say, guess what? Jesus appears, he's alive. And what does Thomas say? I need to see the nail hands. I need to touch. I need to put my hand into his side. Only when I can touch and see and have God appear to me directly, that's when I will believe. And so many people, sometimes God does appear that way. Sometimes God will appear in physical form to prove his existence to you. And I've heard of other people actually experiencing and seeing God. But what about me? I've never seen him. Me, Mark Manning, I have never seen God. Does that mean he does not exist? Look what happens when Jesus comes. Jesus tells him, because you have seen me, you have believed. Because he says, hey, look, okay, here I am. I've appeared to you. Here's the nail marks. Here's the side. But blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Blessed. Blessed are you if you believe that there is a God and you have not seen him. Not everyone is going to see God. Eventually, someday, everyone will see God in the final judgment. But not everyone during this lifetime is going to see God. Does that mean he does not exist? If we cannot physically see him with our own eyes, does that mean he does not exist? No, of course not. Sometimes we have to take the eyewitness accounts of other people. This is the Charlie's Angels syndrome, right? You ever seen that movie? It's a great movie. It just got out on video. Drew Barrymore, Lucy Liu, and Cameron Diaz, right? And the whole premise of the movie is that these three people go around being funded by a millionaire that no one's ever seen. And so they all through the thing, they want to eventually meet Charlie. Well, sure enough, they end up at Charlie's house, and they're all very excited, and Charlie actually isn't there. And then they end up on the beach, and they're sitting there on the beach, and they're drinking some coconut drinks, right? And the Drew Barrymore character, and they're talking to Charlie. Charlie's, I guess, on some cell phone, and they're listening to him on a little voice box. And Drew Barrymore just turns around, and she believes that she sees Charlie. Now, I was kind of disappointed. Why didn't Drew Barrymore go, I've seen Charlie? Because chances are, they would say, you're crazy. What do we do when we talk to people and they say, I've seen God? Had a bad steak last night, didn't you? You've been hallucinating again. You shouldn't be smoking that stuff, I told you. And we start thinking that they're maybe a little loony, a little eccentric, a little crazy. But that's really not the case. Some people will be able to see him, but others won't. Take a look at this next passage from Hebrews. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. Everyone has faith. Everyone has it. The question is, what do you have faith in? Even the atheist, even the one that believes in the evolutionary process, even the one that believes in the Big Bang theory, has to go on faith. Why? Because they cannot reproduce the Big Bang. You can try it as many times as you want. You will never be able to scientifically prove the Big Bang theory. They're taking it on faith. And we just take something else on faith. So we cannot dismiss the fact that God shows himself. But again, if you think about it, of all the history of the world and mankind, how many people are living on this world now? Boy, you want to talk about a lot of appearances. God's going to be showing up all over the place. That would be a lot of work. And again, we would always try and dismiss it. We would always still have those nagging doubts. Well, maybe they were just making it up, or maybe this, because I've never seen it myself. How can you, if you were God, try and prove yourself to the human race? Well, I think you do it. Go to the next one. It should be a black slide. You know how you do it? It's this next one. I never saw this until I was reading this. You can prove that you are God if you can predict the future. Only a being outside space and time who knows past, present, and future can tell you what the future is in specific, minute dates. I'm not talking about the horoscopes that say, you're going to have a good day today. All that. I love reading that stuff because it's very vague. And you will feel blessed in your work as you honor those around you. Oh, my goodness. break open the Chinese fortune cookies. My goodness, this is horrible. Now, I'm talking about specific future holding events. And that's exactly what God did in the Bible. You start taking a look at the Bible and all the stuff that's there, he specifically gave future events. We just looked at it in the book of Daniel. He gave future events of what exactly was going to happen. He gave predictions and even proves he talks about it in the book of Isaiah. Who then is like me? Let him proclaim it. Let him foretell what is to come. If you are God, then you can tell me what the future is. Check out this next one. I foretold the former things long ago. My mouth announced them, and I made them known. He's banking on something, saying, hey, only God can tell you what the future is. Look at the next one. Therefore, I told you these things long ago, before they happened. I announced them to you so that you could say, my horoscope, my idols did them. If you can predict the future, then you are God. Only God can do this. And he banks on it, and he says, your idols can't do it, only I can. And he does it over and over again. And that's why predictive prophecy in the Bible is so important and so crucial. We don't look at it a whole lot, but it's very crucial. And that's why a lot of people spend a lot of time trying to take down the Bible. Go to the next slide. It should be black. Good. So God has authenticated himself, our God, the true God, by predicting the future and showing that stuff up in the Bible. And because there's none other that have been able to do it. Now check out this next idea. Even Jesus did this. Do I have these up there? Because how? Jesus became one of us, didn't he? Right? That's the next one, become one of us. John 1, check this out. It would be great, you know, if God, if we were a bunch of ants, what would be the best way to try and go and communicate with ants? Well, it probably wouldn't be to take a vacuum cleaner and suck them up, right? Which is what I did just the other day. You don't want to do that. The best way to communicate and talk to ants would be what? Become one of the ants. So God, wouldn't it be great if God became one of us? Wouldn't that be amazing? That would be a huge thing of self-authentication. Oh, John 1:14, the Word became flesh, made his dwelling among us. We have seen the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. This person showed up. Check out what he says. So be on your guard. I have told you everything ahead of time. Even Jesus said that I am authentic because I can tell you the future. And only God can tell you the future. And then check this out. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. Now that's pretty amazing, because if any of you could tell me when you're going to die and that 3 days later you're going to come back to life, I would be shocked and amazed and I'd fall down and worship you. That is huge, that God in the person of Jesus Christ can predict his death and come back to life again. That is huge. He's self-authenticated. Go to the next one. Should be black. And then also Jesus verified himself by doing many miracles. And miracles are another proof. I didn't write that on there, but I should have, with miracles and experience. I'm going to tell you about a guy who was told that he needed to go on dialysis on Monday or Tuesday, or else he was going to be dead. That's what the doctor said. I've looked at all the tests. I've looked at all the stuff. If you're not on dialysis, you'll be dead within the week. Well, we prayed for him last week. I'm sitting in my office. And we just prayed and prayed over this man. And you know, we specifically, actually Brian specifically prayed that God let it be that when he walks into the doctor's office, that the doctors go, what happened? Where did it go? What took place here? And that's what we prayed for. And that's exactly what happened. You see him, he's Jesse, our guitar player right there. That was him. We prayed for him and prayed for him. He went into the doctor and the doctor said, what new exercise have you been doing? What new diet have you been on? How in the world? And are you on dialysis? Nope. Not on dialysis. Why? Because it's gone. Because a miracle took place, and that authenticates God's power and promise and presence. And that's what Jesus did in his whole lifetime, was he did miracles just like this, healing people, raising them from the dead, giving them sight, giving them hearing. And through experience. Now, and I'm not just saying that, again, I can hear the argument, yeah, well, I've heard atheists claim that too. I've heard the Baha'is or the Hindus or the Islams. I've heard all of them make those miraculous claims. You combine experience with predictions and becoming one of us and appearing and the freedom and the morality and the creation argument. You put them all together and you're talking about a big 1-2 punch to the idea of atheism. There's an element of faith. There's an element that says we cannot prove anything. The Jodie Foster character in this movie, at one point, She was saying, how can a God give no proofs of his existence? And the Matthew McConaughey character looked at her and said, did you love your father? What? Did you love your father? Well, of course. Prove it. We cannot scientifically reproduce God, but we can have arguments. We can have ideas and concepts. And when you lump them all together, you get a very huge, powerful vehicle known as Christianity, known as the true God, worshiper, and that's where we end up.